This morning I want us to look at the 18th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, Acts chapter 18. I'll begin by reading, beginning in the first verse, down through the 11th verse as we speak on the subject, encouragement for God's servant. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth, and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy, with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius, the emperor of Rome, had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome, and Paul came unto them. And because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought, for by their occupation they were tent makers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. And when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was Christ. And when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, he shook his raiment and said unto them, Your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From henceforth I will go unto the Gentiles. And he departed thence and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house joined hard to the synagogue. And Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. Then spake the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision, Be not afraid, but speak, and hold not thy peace, for I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee, for I have much people in this city. And he continued there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. It has been said that it is next to a professional sin in the ministry to be publicly discouraged. I think that's true. That's true because discouragement is like a contagious virus. It spreads easily from person to person. If I came up here this morning and said, Brethren, I don't know if there's much hope for the future. Looks like we're on our last leg. I'll tell you, that virus would spread through this congregation. And you could see the enthusiasm just wane as discouragement infected the whole crowd. It spreads very easily and quickly. Yet at the same time, even though it's next to a professional sin to be publicly discouraged in the ministry, I think we would all agree that every preacher, and every Christian for that matter, does in fact from time to time struggle with what Charles Spurgeon once called the minister's fainting fits. We become cast down, don't we? And we sink down the slippery slope into the slough of despond. It happens. Probably not a one of you here this morning that hasn't been discouraged from time to time in your life. We become weary. We become tired. That happens to preachers too. For preachers, sometimes the catalyst is just a single harsh or critical word that maybe wasn't even intended to hurt, but yet perhaps the criticism had a barb on it, and it'll send the preacher into an emotional tailspin and make him feel that his labors are really useless. Sometimes his personal burdens and family pressures, which generally cannot be shared with others, weigh upon his mind and discourage the minister. Most preachers from time to time struggle with a sense of failure because of an anemic pulpit effort, or perhaps a season of less than spectacular pulpit efforts, the relative absence of any discernible fruit from his labors is sometimes a cause for discouragement. I can't tell you how many preachers have told me that I haven't baptized anybody in so many years or so many months, and I'm beginning to wonder if the Lord is blessing my labors. It's a common cause for discouragement in the ministry. And the sheer fact that a preacher deals with an intangible product. You know, if you build a structure on your property, you can stand back at the end of each day and see the progress that you've made. Because it's tangible. It's something you can touch and see. And it's material, but yet when you deal with people's hearts, their souls, their lives, that's often very amorphous. It's intangible. It's not easy to gauge whether you're making much progress. The preacher deals with an intangible product. Now, some people may be prone to discouragement by natural temperament. There are different personalities, are there not? If you had multiple children, you probably remember that each one was his or her own person. And some people are just more prone to look on the glum side than others. They're melancholy by natural temperament. Some people struggle with that. And then obviously some preachers get discouraged not only because they have a tendency in that direction, naturally speaking, but just the inexperience of youth sometimes is a reason, because once you start meeting with obstacles and the burdens and the pressures of ministry, sometimes a younger man who hasn't been somewhat hardened through experience will want to give up. But I suggest that even the strongest saints, who are not naturally prone to melancholy or who are not inexperienced, but sometimes even the strongest saints grow weary and faint. I think of several in the scriptures like David in 2 Samuel 21:15, where we're told that in his mature years he waxed faint in the heat of the battle, and he almost died. One of Goliath's grandsons almost killed him, and had it not been for a man named Abishai, David would have died on that occasion, and they told him after that episode that you're not to go out with us to battle anymore. You're just not able to sustain the pace. You see, as he got older, he wasn't quite at the top of his game anymore. That happens to each of us. And sometimes, dear friends, with the passage of time, we become, even though we've been very strong in the past, we begin to lose heart. Loneliness, disappointment, fear, and just the pressures of life get to us. Even Moses' hands grew weary. Do you remember, as long as Moses held up his hands, the children of Israel prevailed? But when his hands grew weary and they began to drop, then the enemy prevailed, and Aaron's two boys came and held up his hands and gave him the strength that he needed. Sometimes even the Moseses need a little support. Even John the Baptist reached a point when he was in prison when he questioned whether he had been deceived all along. Now, I say all of this because this is exactly where we find the eminent Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 18, the passage that I've read in your hearing this morning. Evidently, Paul was a bit discouraged and weary on this occasion. Let's look at a portrait first of a weary and discouraged preacher. The first thing I think we can say is he was all alone. If you look back into the 17th chapter of Acts, the previous chapter, verse 13, you'll read that the brethren sent Paul away, but Silas and Timothy abode there still. Up until this moment, Paul has had teammates. Two young preachers, Silas and Timothy, have been with him, but now he's all alone. And you know, don't you, that as you grow older in life and you spend more time alone, and no doubt each of us have been more isolated this year as far as social contact than we have probably at any time in our history. Even those who have families have been pretty well to themselves, but maybe you're a widow or a widower here this morning, or a single parent, and you spend much of your time all by yourself. You know, it's easy in situations like that to feel that you are all alone. I suggest Paul is all alone on this occasion. Verse 16 says, "And while Paul waited for Silas and Timothy to come to him, while he was at Athens," for the first time in his ministry, Paul is all alone. My heart goes out to him. You say, well, we're talking about Paul. I mean, a picture of resilience and courage. I mean, Paul was made of 90% grit, somebody says. No, he was a man of like passions, like as we are. And loneliness takes a toll on somebody. Some of you know that by experience, don't you? You say, well, I'm not lonely. I have social media. I can talk to people, but you know, there's not an awful lot you can say in 140 characters or less. And you certainly can't get a human touch. And it's not the same as looking at somebody eye to eye and enjoying an embrace or a handshake. Paul was lonely. And furthermore, he had been flogged and imprisoned at Philippi. I've never been flogged for preaching the gospel. I would imagine it would be a traumatic experience, don't you imagine? For them to take your shirt off of your back and to tie you to a whipping post and to give you 40 stripes, save one, 39 stripes. We're in Acts 18 this morning, two chapters earlier at Philippi. He was flogged and then thrown into prison. Then in the 17th chapter, we learn that he was assaulted by a mob, a rioting mob at Thessalonica and again at Berea. Paul was an old Baptist preacher in the first century, and he was alone. And he was traveling and telling others the good news of the gospel of grace, preaching Jesus Christ and Him crucified, and seeking to establish churches. He was laboring where the ground had never been broken. He was laboring in fallow ground, seeking to clear the land and to plant a gospel crop. The Apostle Paul was doing hard work as an evangelist. We have church buildings. We have church members. I was called to pastor this church over 5 years ago, and I came here, and we already had a group of church members. And we've lost some of them. We've had a few added. But you see, there was already an established church here. Paul didn't have that. He had to start from ground zero. And we're here today because somebody started from ground zero at some point in the past for us, right? We are reaping the benefits of somebody else's labors in the past. Others have sowed and we have reaped their harvest. The Apostle Paul, though, was alone. He had been flogged and imprisoned. He had been assaulted by a mob. But that would be intimidating. I don't like it when anybody disagrees with me or acts like they don't like me, but to have a whole mob standing right there screaming in your face. You know, when a mob gets together, they lose their minds. Isn't that right? It's called the mob spirit. People who would one-on-one be more respectful, when they get into a group like that, they lose their focus. And that's what was happening to Paul. He was the object of their vitriol and persecution. And then he went to Athens in Acts 17, and he had meager success there. We're told at the end of Acts 17 that a few believed. He had a couple that clave to him that believed, but for the most part, the people were either noncommittal. They said, "We will hear thee again on this matter," and others just blatantly rejected his preaching. So his success was marginal at best at Athens. Now he comes to Corinth, verse 1. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth. Now Corinth was a very important city in southern Greece. And the Greeks were not Jews for the most part, but there were Jewish people in that city. We're told in verse 2, he found a certain Jew there named Aquila and his wife Priscilla. And this couple had lately come from Italy, where it says Claudius, the emperor, had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome. Now, it is one of the most well-documented facts of ancient history that in 52 AD, the Emperor Claudius expelled all the Jews from Rome because they were causing civil disturbance, and the trouble had reached a point that Claudius said, "Okay, you have to leave." Both Suetonius, the reputable Roman historian, and later Tacitus mention this edict and indicate that the trouble that had arisen was for the cause of a teacher named Crestus. And the reference is obviously to Jesus Christ, to Christ. And two of those Jewish Christians named Aquila and Priscilla, the husband-wife team, have now come to Corinth. And Paul, when he comes to Corinth, finds these two Jews, says verse 2, and because they were of the same craft, he abode with them. Now, evidently they were well off, because only wealthy people were homeowners in that day. Others might be able to rent a room, but Aquila and Priscilla had bought a home. They had lodging with room for guests. So Paul, it says, abode with them and wrought, for by their occupation, they were of the same craft. They were tent makers. Now, we think of tents like canvas tents, but tents in that day were made primarily with leather, with goat skin. A tent maker was someone who had learned how to tan goat hide, how to take the hair off of the hide of a goat and to sew the hair together to make ropes and so forth, and then to take the hide and to tan it, and then to sew it in a way that would make lodging for the poor. Paul was a tent maker. These two, Aquila and Priscilla, were also tent makers by trade. And it's likely that they met at synagogue. It was not uncommon in the Jewish synagogues of that day for certain synagogues to seat worshipers by occupation. All of the stone workers would sit together, and all of the farmers and agricultural workers would sit together. And here are the tent makers. So it's very possible that Paul, going to the Jewish synagogue on the Saturday Sabbath, had met Aquila and Priscilla, fellow Jews. They discovered they had something in common. We're both tent makers. And they said, "Do you have any place to stay?" And he said, "I don't." They said, "Well, why don't you come stay with us?" And during the day, he worked making tents to support himself while they worked as well. So here's the Apostle Paul, tired, lonely, and he's afraid. As you read in our text, verse 9, "Then the Lord said to Paul by night in a vision, 'Be not afraid.'" Now, there would be no need to say, "Don't be afraid," unless Paul was leaning toward fear, unless he was, in a sense, afraid. And if anybody knew that, God did. Now, perhaps you say this morning, "Wait, just a minute, Brother Mike, Paul? You're saying Paul was discouraged and afraid?" I know it sounds incredible, again, for no one was more courageous and resilient than Paul. But this isn't the only time that Paul admits to being afraid. If you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 5, he says, "Without were fightings and within were fears." You see, Paul was a man, just like you are a man, just like I'm a man. He was human. I wonder if any of you have struggled with fear over this virus. I think it's a real challenge. I think it's something that we have to really be careful not to let it get on top of us, you know. It's right to be wise and judicious. It's right to know that there are dangers. But you know, there are dangers everywhere in this world. Would you agree with that? I get a cold virus almost every year. And usually it goes from my head down into my lungs, and I get a secondary bacterial infection and need a round of antibiotics. There are dangers aplenty out in this world. You say, "Well, does that mean we shouldn't be..." No, obviously we should all be very careful. We should be wise. We should be judicious. But the point that I make is that fear has torment. Fear can get you and keep you in bondage, can it not? Not just over a disease, but the fear of an accident. You know, there are some people who struggle with fear to the point that they won't leave their home. What if I have a car wreck? Now, if you've had a wreck, you know it takes a lot of courage to get back in the car, right? Like falling off a horse. You've fallen off a horse. It takes a lot of courage to get back up on top of that horse, but that's part of the process of overcoming that fear, not letting it rule you, but you staying in control of it. The Apostle Paul was afraid. We all know what that feels like, right? You ever been afraid of things that go bump in the night? You know, when you're a widow woman, sometimes you hear noises and it's frightening. When you're a child, a little child, sometimes you are afraid of a bully at school, some dominant personality that is the leader and a bunch of the kids are trying to win his or her approval, and this bully has picked you out for some reason and seems to, and you know the paralyzing fear of wondering what's going to happen to you tomorrow at school. Fear is universal human experience. It shouldn't surprise us then that God says to Paul, "Be not afraid." Because this resilient, courageous apostle to the Gentiles, who never minced his words, who was courageous in his proclamation of the gospel, even in the face of ridicule and opposition, this man, I suggest for consideration, dear friends, his problems are starting to get on top of him. His burdens are growing heavy. He's growing tired and weary, and he's struggling with fear. I mean, if you'd just been flogged two chapters earlier and put in prison, and then a mob had assaulted you in two cities, and you came to another city, you would say, "Okay, I need a little R&R. I'm going to go to Corinth for a little vacation. I'm going to sit back and just take a leave of absence, a sabbatical for a while. I need to lick my wounds and recover. I'm not ready to get back into the harness." And really, that's sort of what's happening here. He starts making tents. Now, he's making tents, I suggest, because he's not only tired and lonely and afraid, but he's also probably financially in need. Evidently, this is the first time in Paul's apostolic labors that it was necessary for him to support himself financially. But today, we have a number of preachers among the Primitive Baptists who are bivocational, and I think it's an admirable thing. In fact, I would say the majority of our ministers are required to maintain secular work as well as preach on the weekends. It's not the ideal situation, obviously, for the Bible teaches us that they that preach the gospel should live of the gospel. We shouldn't muzzle the mouth of the ox that treads out the corn. You know, if you've got an oxen that's doing the work, then don't put a muzzle on him to keep him from eating some of the grain that he's treading. The Bible teaches us that it's appropriate for God's people, if a servant of God rules well, he's worthy of double honor, and that means not just that you put him on a pedestal higher than the others. That reference to honor has to do with financial remuneration or support. Honor your father and mother, that's the same word there. It has to do with taking care of them physically, financially. He says, let those that rule well and labor in the word and doctrine be counted worthy of double honor, that is full financial support. Paul had been supported by the church at Antioch when he first set out on his preaching trips, his preaching journeys. And now on this second journey, he's been supported by brethren, but now all alone, his money has run out and he has to work to make ends meet, to have something to eat. You say, why didn't he just take his debit card out? Well, you know, that card's no better than the money in the bank that it represents, right? Sometimes young people will say, Dad, you've got plenty of money. Just you use your debit card. Just use your card. Well, sorry, but there's nothing in the bank to support the use of that card. You've got to have something backing it up. Well, the Apostle Paul didn't have a debit card. He didn't have a savings account. As far as we know, the Apostle Paul was living very frugally, but yet he had run out of his resources. And it is an admirable thing that in order to support himself rather than to be a burden on people, and of course he's in Corinth, there's not a group of Christians, there's not a church there. The people there have no obligation to him. The Apostle Paul says, I've got to eat. And I know if I'm going to eat, I need to make money. So he works to support himself. So here's a man that's alone. He's been persecuted recently. He's struggling with fear. He's tired. Perhaps he's even physically ill. He's financially struggling. And it says that as he reasoned, verse 4, in the synagogue every Sabbath, verse 6 says that the Jews opposed themselves and blasphemed. They rejected his ministry, his preaching. He's trying to testify to them, prove to them that Jesus is the Christ. Jesus is the Messiah. And Paul is preaching this to these Jews, but he meets with significant opposition from them. When it says they blasphemed, that has reference to abusive speech. Now, this isn't just, well, we don't really agree with you, Paul. This is calling him names, ridiculing him, abusing him verbally, verbal abuse. The Jews were upset at Paul. Now, I like to preach to people who nod their heads like this. I don't like to preach to people who nod their heads like this, especially if they do it in a pronounced way like that. You know? It's just natural to want to be accepted and to want people to listen to you and consider what you're saying and to make friends. Nobody likes to have opposition. Nobody likes him. He doesn't have any friends. And it's taking a toll on him. Furthermore, the environment in which he finds himself is especially challenging. Corinth was the Vanity Fair of ancient Greece. It was Sin City, the ancient Las Vegas, if you please, or the ancient New York City. It was a cosmopolitan city. It was a commercial center where all different kinds of races and peoples came through to trade their goods, a mercantile center, and it was a corrupt city. For somebody to call you a Corinthian was not a compliment in that day. In fact, the word became a byword, a synonym for debauchery and perversion. The city of Corinth boasted the Temple of Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, which was one of the architectural wonders of the ancient world, a temple that housed 10,000 priestess prostitutes. Paul wrote to the book of Romans from Corinth. And if you read Romans 1, verses 24 to 32, the description he gives there of a society that has been turned over to a reprobate mind is probably a reflection of what he was witnessing in the city of Corinth as he wrote Romans, a city where men burn in their lusts one to another, women with women, and where God has turned them over to a reprobate mind. This is the portrait of a discouraged preacher. I want you to notice now in the moments remaining the ways that the Lord mercifully encourages his servant. Now, I'm so glad that God doesn't leave his preachers in a discouraged state, but he is very merciful to encourage his servants. And there's not a one of us, whether you're a preacher or a believer in the pew, I dare say each one of us will need encouragement from the Lord from time to time. Now you say, well, I'm going to be an encourager. I'm thankful for you. Good deal. We need more encouragers in the church. But you know, ultimately the best encouragement that you or I could receive comes from the Lord himself. And God knows how to encourage his people. He knows how to encourage the lonely, the frightened, the discouraged, the weary, the fatigued. He knows how to encourage those who are financially struggling. And notice the three ways God encouraged Paul. First, he gave him companionship. Verse 5. When Silas and Timothy were come from Macedonia. Now remember, back in chapter 17, Paul left to go to Athens, and Silas and Timothy abode there still at Berea, and he is waiting for them to come. And in the meantime, he's gone from Berea to Athens and now to Corinth, and he's wondering, am I ever going to see Timothy and Silas again? Finally, they show up. And verse 5 says, when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, you can mark it down, my beloved, that the reunion with these two precious brethren was a great comfort to the Apostle Paul. When you're alone to see a familiar face, especially somebody you trust, a colleague, two young preachers came and Paul must have embraced them and said, oh, you're a sight for sore eyes. My beloved, we need each other, don't we? If I can paraphrase John Donne, no man is an island to himself. No preacher or no Christian is an island to himself or herself. You can't make it on your own. When Jesus sent the disciples out in Matthew chapter 10, he sent them out by two and two in teams, because as Ecclesiastes chapter 4 says, if one falls, the other can lift him up. If one is cold, the other can warm him. I do better with a teammate. You do better with a teammate, right? Because the fact is, there's a difference in having acquaintances and real friends. And if you were to really be honest today, I would imagine very few of us have what we would call a lot of just genuine, real friends. But we have a friend in Jesus. He's a friend that sticks closer than a brother. He'll be with you through thick and thin. He'll love you at all times. When you're up, when you're down, when you're on your best behavior, when you're not, Jesus Christ is a loyal friend. There's not a friend like the lowly Jesus. No, not one. No, not one. Don't you love that song? What a friend we have in Jesus, all our sins and griefs to bear. What a privilege to carry everything to God in prayer. Indeed, dear beloved, I tell you today that Jesus is a friend indeed. And if God has given you a Silas or a Timothy here and there, who genuinely cares for your state. I mean, you don't have to worry about how you say things or what you look like, but you know that they'll receive you. They love you for who you are. They are concerned about your welfare. They share your basic conviction. They may not see eye to eye on every single issue, but yet there's somebody that you can share your thoughts with and not fear recrimination. Usually a husband and wife team is supposed to be such a friendship. It is. If you've had a friend like that, it's a great blessing. If you have a friend like that, don't take it for granted. I'm so thankful for that, but some of you have had it and you don't have it anymore. You say, well, I don't have many friends, Brother Mike. May I say God encourages his people by giving them a friend here and there, a genuine friend. And I suggest that you will probably find your best friends in the house of God. That line from the song that we sing sometimes means something to me. The friends that I most cherish on life's rugged road are the friends of my master, the children of God. They're the best friends I've ever had. When Silas and Timothy came and met Paul, it must have encouraged him just to see them again. And further, we learn in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 9, that these two preach brethren who came from Macedonia brought financial assistance from the churches at Philippi and Thessalonica and probably Berea. They brought financial assistance to Paul. His financial needs were finally resolved. And I want to say that God is faithful to supply your needs both socially and financially in your life. And this is evidence that he did it for Paul. He'll do it for you and for me as well. He'll do it. Secondly, notice how God encourages his servant. He gives him, verse 8 says, a little success in terms of several converts. It says that when the Jews, verse 6, opposed themselves and blasphemed, Paul shook out his raiment as an object lesson, like the prophets of old. You know, the prophets in the Old Testament used to illustrate their sermons. Paul is saying, all right, I want to get any hint of your rebellion against the truth of God off of me. I'm out of here. I'm leaving. I'm going to the Gentiles. So he left synagogue, and notice what it says in the next verse. And he departed thence, and he entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshiped God, whose house joined fast, that is, right next door to the synagogue. Yeah, that'll show them. Paul says, I'm getting out of here. I'm going to blow the dust of this crummy little synagogue off my clothes and get out of Dodge. And Paul says, I'm going next door. Oh, yeah, that'll show them, Paul. You just go next door. But this turns out to be very wise, because the next verse says, and Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed and was baptized. You look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul says, I baptize none of you save Crispus and Gaius. Crispus, Paul did baptize him. He was the ruler of the synagogue. He was like the pastor of the Jewish church or synagogue. And he converted to Christianity, and Paul had a convert, and it says, and his whole house believed on the Lord. His family became members of the church too. And many of the Corinthians hearing believed and were baptized. So you have the nucleus or the beginnings of a New Testament church. God encouraged Paul by giving him a little fruit for his labor. You know, I have preachers sometimes tell me, as I stated, Brother Mike, I've been here so such and such time, I haven't baptized a single person. I say, I hear you. I know. It's discouraging. You try to preach, you pray that the Lord will work, not just so that you can, we're not trying to manufacture results or just grow a church so that we can count numbers and noses. We want to see genuine converts, people whose hearts have been touched, who truly believe in the Lord and who are willing to devote their lives to serving such a wonderful Savior. And we pray that the Lord will do that. But you know, about the time, it seemed, this has been my experience, that I just give up hope. And I'll maybe have a very poor effort one Sunday, and I'll say, okay, so now it's a hymn. We're going to open the doors of the church. If anybody feels a burden to join, you come ahead. About that time, somebody will come down the aisle and it'll surprise me. I'll know the Lord did it. Isn't God gracious to encourage us with converts? And then this is what I really want to get to. Verses 9 and 10. God gave Paul not only two friends to encourage him, Silas and Timothy, and then he gave him some converts, some fruit from his labor, but he gives him a special reassurance in a night vision. Verse 9 says, then spake the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision. Now, I'm so glad to believe in a God who can communicate comfort and encouragement to his people, not only through public preaching, through the word, but he can come to you in the privacy of your own bedroom, in your heart of hearts, and he can send you a message. And I dare say that we need to be careful when we start talking about God communicating personally to us, because some people use that idea in order to control others. God told me our church is supposed to go this direction. I suggest God doesn't give direction to one person privately so that they can manipulate other people to do what they want. I've always thought of that story. I think I've told it to you before, where the young preacher came up to Charles Spurgeon and said, "Mr. Spurgeon, God told me I'm supposed to preach in your pulpit next Sunday." And Spurgeon said, "Well, that's funny. I was just talking to him and he didn't say a word to me about it." You know, that's the problem with saying God spoke to me, because you can't validate it. It can't be verified. But I'll tell you, sometimes God does communicate to individuals for that person's encouragement or that person's guidance. Maybe you've been walking through a dark valley and you're really beaten down. You're broken. Your heart is heavy and you're just wondering if you can keep going. God is faithful to come to you at your hour of need and to comfort and encourage you. He's done it in my life. I could tell you a couple of stories where he's broken through the clouds and given me fresh hope. That's what happens on this occasion. The Lord spoke to Paul by night in a vision, and here's God's message. "Be not afraid, but speak, and hold not thy peace." Evidently, Paul is thinking, well, I just need to lay low. The pressure, the city's so corrupt and sinful, and I've had so many problems lately, and it seems that the Jews that I've preached to have blasphemed and abused me verbally, and they've rejected my ministry, and I just need to try to fly below the radar for a while. God says, don't stop, Paul. Hold not thy peace. Don't quit preaching. And here are the three encouragements that he shouldn't quit preaching. First, for I will be with thee. The promise of God's presence. If you're a preacher or a believer in the pew, and you're discouraged, you're weary, you're faint today, I'm telling you, God has promised to be with you all the way to the end. He will be with you. Don't you love that promise repeated over and over to God's servants in the Bible? Joshua chapter 1, verse 5, "There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee, nor forsake thee." God will never forsake you, dear child of grace. He won't. He will be with you. He will be with you in some lonely village. He will be with you at your workplace. He will be with you as you raise your children. He will be with you as you've passed through the valleys of affliction and sickness and trial and trauma. I can look back today with 20/20 hindsight and tell you that he has indeed been with me. For 58 years, he's been with me. Even when I didn't have the sense to know the source of my help, he was still watching over me, and his presence has never failed me. Judges chapter 6, verse 16, Gideon says, "Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? My family's the least, and I'm sort of timid." But God says, "Gideon, I will be with thee." If God is with you, there's no reason to be afraid. If you're faithfully serving him, my beloved, you can bank on it that the Lord is with you while you be with him. He will be with you. And if you seek him, he will be found of you. I'm quoting a verse in 2 Chronicles 15. The Lord is with you while you be with him. You say, "I want to be on the Lord's side." Then you can depend on the fact that he will be with you. Don't you love that promise in Isaiah 41:10? "Fear not, I am with thee. Oh, be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee, I will help thee, yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness." And of course, that verse is one of the verses quoted in that wonderful old hymn, "How Firm a Foundation." God's promise to be with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. I'm talking to you today, dear friend. Secondly, the promise of his protection. "I will be with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee." Now, this is probably a promise specific to Paul on this occasion. Obviously, it doesn't mean that God would insulate him from harm for the rest of his life. For after this, he is imprisoned on two occasions, and he finally suffers death by martyrdom. But on this particular occasion, God promises Paul, "Though you have many things to be afraid of, a lot of opposition, I'm going to specially hedge you about and protect you so that no man shall set on thee to hurt thee." And may I say that that happened on that occasion. God told him in advance that no harm would come to him. And if you read on in this chapter, the people that are opposing him are finally dispersed from the city by Gallio, says verse 14. where they can't harm Paul. But you know, the principle that's here is certainly true for each of us. Isaiah 54:17, this is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, that no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper. And my friends, we should always pray to God and depend upon Him to be our shield and defender against all of the dangers, whether they're health dangers, whether they're persecution dangers, whatever the dangers that we face, we should depend on God to be our shield and defender. And this principle also applies in the sense when He says, no man shall set on thee to hurt thee, the promise of God's protection, in the sense that man cannot ultimately harm or defeat the cause that we represent. They can kill the body, but they can't kill the soul. In other words, you and I do not participate in a losing cause this morning. If you don't get anything else that I tried to preach, remember that you do not participate in a losing cause. The kingdom of God will prevail. Finally, He says, be not afraid, but speak. Hold not thy peace. I'm with you, Paul. I'll protect you, Paul. Notice thirdly, the promise of God's sovereign grace. For I have much people in this city. In other words, before you come to preach, Paul, I've already preceded you. I've gone ahead of you. Isn't it wonderful to know that before the preacher gets there, the Lord's already gone ahead of him? He's not depending on me for the ultimate success of his program of salvation. The Lord has chosen a people in Christ before the world began, and they're his. I have much people. He didn't say, I will get much people in this city. He already has them. He has them by electing grace. He chose them as his own. And then he's already prepared the hearts in regeneration. You know, before the preacher's words can ever get through to somebody, God has to open their heart like he did Lydia of old, whose heart the Lord opened, that she attended to the things that were spoken by Paul. And I'm glad to tell you that the Lord is faithful to go before the gospel by tendering the hearts of his people in regenerating grace, giving them spiritual life. And those are the only people who will respond to the gospel, those who've been previously given spiritual life. Regeneration must precede faith. In other words, you have to be born again before you can believe. So you show me somebody that believes, I'll show you somebody that the Lord's already touched their heart. God says to Paul, keep preaching, Paul. I have much people in Corinth. You say, in Corinth? You mean this wicked sin city? God has people here? God knew better than Paul did who his children were. And he says, Paul, keep preaching. There's hope for success because I have much people in this city. It's not a little group of people. It's much people. God has many children. And my beloved, I want to tell you, he has much people in Shalot. He has much people in Calabash. He has much people in Little River. He has much people in Myrtle Beach and North Myrtle Beach. He has much people in Wilmington. He has much people in this area. I believe God has a big family, and that's why I want to keep preaching, because I have hope for success. To know that there are his little children out there who hunger and thirst for the gospel that has brought me such joy and such peace. There's a hymn in our hymn book, hymn number 125, written by a Lutheran pastor named Martin Rinkert. He pastored a little church in the walled town of Eilenburg, Germany, during the horrors of the 30-year war between 1618 and 1648. That city became an overcrowded refuge for the surrounding area during that war. And as the people came into the city, they brought epidemic, disease, and famine with them. And before long, a pestilence, a plague, a virus spread through Eilenburg. And at the beginning of 1637, the year of the great pestilence, there were four preachers in that little community. One abandoned his post for health reasons. He left town. Rinkert preached the funerals of the other two. He alone was left. And as the only pastor remaining, he began to conduct funerals for people who died from the plague. Often he would conduct 40 to 50 funerals a day. By the time the plague was finished, he had buried 4,480 people in all. In May of that year, 1637, his own wife died from the plague. By the end of that year, the refugees were being buried in trenches, big ditches. There were so many at a time. In the face of this overwhelming pressure and the constant risk and horrendous conditions, Martin Rinkert never stopped ministering to the people of his city, even at personal risk of catching the disease. He gave away nearly everything he owned to the poor and the needy in his community, though he could barely clothe and feed his own children, who had been left again motherless by the death of their mother. He mortgaged his own future income, his property, and his future to provide for his family and his community. At one point, toward the end of the war, the Swedish army surrounded Eilenberg. They demanded an enormous sum of money from the impoverished and starving citizens. Knowing that his people didn't have the money, Rinkert pled with the Swedes to lower the amount, but he was rejected. Martin Rinkert fell on his knees after that meeting, and he said, "Come, my children, we can find no hearing, no mercy with men. Let us take our refuge with our God." He then began to pray so fervently that the Swedish general was moved, and he made the decision to lower the price to less than 5% of the original sum. After nearly 30 years of incessant struggle, it began to look like peace was within grasp and the war was about to end. Desiring to give his children a song to sing to God in thanks at the dinner table, Martin Rinkert sat down and composed this hymn, which would become one of the most well-known Thanksgiving hymns of all time, "Now Thank We All Our God," with heart and hands and voices. Can you see the old preacher with his two little children sitting at their meager table fare, singing this song together? "Who wondrous things hath done, in whom his world rejoices, who from our mother's arms hath blessed us on our way with countless gifts of love, and still is ours today. Oh, may this bounteous God through all our life be near us, with ever joyful hearts and blessed peace to cheer us, and keep us in his grace, and guide us when perplexed, and free us from all ills in this world and the next. All praise and thanks to God the Father now be given, the Son and him who reigns with them in highest heaven, the one eternal God, whom earth and heaven adore, for thus it was and is now and shall be evermore." Indeed, my friends, this God that Martin Rinkert thanked and praised is the God of all comfort. He knows how to encourage his weary servants and his weary children. He cares. He says to you today, "Let not your heart be troubled." And when you begin to faint by the way because of fear and loneliness and disappointment, I want you to remember the promise of his presence, the promise of his protection, and especially the truth that his sovereign grace has already won the victory, so that you and I may rest knowing that the final outcome does not depend upon us at all. He has much people in this city.
You are listening to Grace Alone Radio Network, streaming Bible teaching from a Primitive Baptist perspective, around the clock and around the world.